Homeless Link is the national membership charity for frontline homelessness services. We work to improve services through research, guidance and learning, and campaign for policy change that will ensure everyone has a place to call home and the support they need to keep it.
In this series of the Going Beyond podcast, we will discuss good practice in how to support individuals experiencing homelessness who have complex health and care needs. The episodes will cover dual diagnosis, physical health needs, hoarding, self-neglect, and brain injury. In each episode, we will speak to a guest who will tell us about their roles and expertise and provide practical tips for frontline staff to deliver good practice. I'm Jo Turner, National Practice Development Project Manager at Homeless Link, and I'll be your host. We hope you enjoy it. In this episode, we are joined by Adam Clayton, Interim Service Manager within the Greater Manchester NHS Mental Health Trust, and Dr. Michelle Hacking, clinical psychologist who works alongside Adam in their dual diagnosis team. We talk about the link between homelessness and co-occurring conditions and discuss what good practice looks like in terms of being able to effectively support individuals. So, hello. Hi, Adam. Hi, Michelle. How are you both today?
Hi, good, thank you.
Good, thank you.
Good. So thank you so much for being here today for the Going Beyond podcast. To start us off for the listeners, can you tell us just a bit about yourself and the work you do? So Adam, I'll go to you first.
Hiya, my name's Adam Clayton. I'm an interim service manager within Greater Manchester Mental Health NHS Trust, and I've got responsibility over a number of homeless services that we deliver across Greater Manchester.
Thank you. And Michelle, I'll go to you next.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michelle Hacking. I'm a clinical psychologist and I work alongside Adam at Greater Manchester Mental Health Trust, and I work within the Salford Dual Diagnosis Team.
Amazing, thank you both. So this series of the Going Beyond podcast is all about understanding the complex health and care needs that people experiencing homelessness face and how best to support these individuals. So for this episode, I thought it would be really useful to understand the prevalence and how to support people who have a dual diagnosis. So I guess my first question to you, Michelle, is what do we mean by dual diagnosis?
Well, I think that dual diagnosis can be a confusing term because it can be interpreted differently depending on what area of healthcare in which you work. So in our context, this means coexisting mental illness and substance use, which is a term used by the NICE guidelines as well. But I wonder if the preferred term might be co-occurring conditions. And in Greater Manchester, we have the Co-occurring Mental Health, Alcohol and Drug Network, which is run by Ben Metcalf. And that kind of gives a bit of a explanation as to what the two term dual diagnosis means.
I think it's really interesting to talk about the language, and instead of, why do you think it is important to use kind of co-occurring conditions rather than dual diagnosis, do you think?
I think a lot of it is around stigma and understanding that people who experience mental health difficulties, and especially if they're homeless and are quite often facing multiple disadvantages throughout their life. And it's really important to recognise that these conditions are not anybody's fault and that are existing due to lots of different factors that have gone on.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. So I think it would be really useful to understand the prevalence of people who have kind of these co-occurring conditions who are also experiencing homelessness and why that might be.
Sure. So statistics collected by CHAIN, which I believe was through Homeless Link, showed that for the period of 2022 to 23, 51% of people who were rough sleeping in the Greater London area had mental health support needs, and 32% had a support need relating to drug use, 31% had a support need relating to alcohol, and a third of people had a combination of these difficulties. So it's really important that we're working in this area because it is so prevalent and impacts on such a large amount of people. And those figures are just in London, but it certainly reflects what we see as well in Manchester.
And why do you think that people kind of experiencing homelessness are more likely to have these kind of co-occurring conditions? I know there's a lot of trauma in terms of kind of becoming homeless, and people who experience homeless may have experienced trauma in their lives. So I just wondered if you could kind of talk a little bit around why someone might have these kind of conditions.
Yeah, sure. I think you're absolutely right, Jo, that One of the things we do know from so much research in this area is that there's a direct link between adverse childhood experiences and our outcomes in later life. And we know that children who have experienced multiple adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, as they're sometimes called, such as living in poverty, experiencing domestic abuse within their households, parental substance use, parental mental health difficulties, are far more likely to become homeless in later life or use substances as adults.
Thank you, Michelle. So I think next I kind of want to understand why it's often quite difficult for people with co-occurring conditions to be offered support by mainstream services. It seems that very kind of traditional models kind of deal with one kind of issue at a time. So it'd be interesting to hear kind of what are the difficulties, what are the barriers to people getting the right support?
It's a really good question, and I think it's one for which there's probably multiple answers if you're looking at it from a service delivery and a commissioning perspective, but also looking at it from an individual perspective as well. So just reflecting back on some of the conversations that you've just had around people's adverse experiences in earlier life, there's a challenge for some people around managing and being able to engage with traditional models of service delivery that are often quite prescriptive. They can be perceived as quite punitive in relation to requirements to engage within a set time frame, and if you miss that, then sometimes you need to be re-referred back in. That can quite often influence people's preconceived ideas of how supportive or not a service could be, which could lead to disengagement or someone choosing not to engage in the first place. So there's a lot of personal factors there that are not necessarily driven by somebody's lack of desire for help, but maybe an inability to accept help through traditional models. And then I think those traditional models are also part of the barrier sometimes when we're thinking about people who maybe rough sleeping or at risk of rough sleeping, who've experienced previous trauma and maybe who use substances as well as presenting with mental health support needs. Co-occurring conditions of drugs and alcohol alongside mental health can quite often, through traditional models, be a reason for exclusion, with a suggestion that maybe the use of the substance needs to be addressed in order to ensure that somebody's able to engage with the therapy and the treatment around mental health. And whilst that there's a reasonable assumption that somebody not using substances may be more able to engage with therapy, for example, at the same time, that those substances might be their way of coping because there's an absence of any therapy and coping strategies. So traditional models that require one to be addressed over the other can be quite exclusive rather than inclusive, and then reinforce to people that services are not going to support them, reinforce that sense that services and people will let them down and therefore they need to manage on their own, which reinforces the coping strategies they're using, which then reinforces the barriers to accessing services.
Yeah, it's a real challenge. It would be interesting, Adam, to hear about kind of more about your service model in Greater Manchester, as obviously you've got this dual diagnosis team. So it'd be interesting to see kind of how you've kind of removed those barriers.
First of all, I think it's probably important to say we've not necessarily removed the barriers. We are certainly doing a lot of work to try and support a change in sort of service delivery across the organisation and within Greater Manchester with other services that we work with. But I certainly don't think we've quite nailed it yet. We deliver 6 different homeless services within Greater Manchester. The team that Michelle works within, which is the Salford Dual Diagnosis Homeless Team, and that operates in Salford specifically. It's a partnership model. So we're funded through Salford's Rough Sleeper Initiative monies and work directly with Salford's RSI team to deliver that service. So it's a true partnership model, going out and place-based working, doing outreach engagement work with the Rough Sleeper teams. The models of sort of oversight and not as they would be in mainstream services, so we can work much more flexibly without really rigid KPIs that require engagement within a set time frame and a specific outcome for that person. They're much more reflective of individualized person-centered care and pre-engagement relationship building to look at what might be underpinning somebody's current circumstances, and to try and build up trust and a positive relationship before we even necessarily start with assessments. And that's the same model that's replicated across our other services. So we've got a similar team model, but slightly more enhanced in Manchester. And that the primary element of that is funded through the ICB. So it's health monies. But a lot of our services are not funded through health monies. It comes through RSI, through OHID, and other sort of more non-health funded models. And then in addition to the Salford and the Manchester teams, we deliver through the Great Manchester Combined Authority, Rough Sleeper Initiative services in Bolton and Bury and Stockport and Trafford. So there's a number of different boroughs. We're also involved in what was the Housing First pilot. So one of three nationally is delivered in Greater Manchester. And we were subcontracted within that model to look at how we support the staff on the programme and then also the people referred into the programme. So a lot of what we do is sort of two-pronged. We look at the needs of an individual who is rough sleeping or at risk of rough sleeping, and we look at how we build relationships and get to a point where we can successfully, positively complete an assessment of need. And then we also do a lot of work around supporting staff and within the partnerships, so building capacity and understanding. And then in addition to those models, we've also got two services funded through Rough Sleeper Drug and Alcohol Treatment Grant monies. And we deliver those in Bolton and Salford. And that's delivering a drug and alcohol treatment model through assertive outreach. So again, working with the homeless sector, with the Rough Sleeper teams, working with our teams in Salford and in Bolton, where we've got the RSI funding, and looking inclusively at co-occurring, co-presenting needs. So rather than have a model where there's a set referral criteria with a specific condition and an exclusion of others, we operate our services where we consider inclusivity of need and deliver that based on individual person-centered needs.
That sounds amazing. Adam, thank you for sharing that. I don't know, Michelle, if you wanted to kind of comment on your kind of service model at all in Salford.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to add to what Adam was saying as well about the idea that lots of mainstream services are quite excluding. If you have drug or alcohol difficulties or mental health, there's lots of kind of closed doors. And the thing that I love the most about the service that we work within and within the Homeless Hub is this kind of idea of there's no wrong door. We take referrals for people who are homeless, either rough sleeping or in temporary accommodation, who have mental health difficulties and many other co-occurring needs or conditions such as drug and alcohol use. So it really feels like we are working to reduce that stigma and to allow people into our service just exactly as they are, regardless of what issues they're facing, what challenges they're up against. You know, we'll take those in partnership with, well, in my case, in partnership with Salford Council housing workers as well. So that feels like, you know, that's an excellent way to work. And, you know, it really is keeping the person at the centre.
Yeah, absolutely. I think kind of moving on from that is, I think it would be useful to hear about how frontline workers can best support people with co-occurring conditions. So you've touched on kind of keeping it person-centred, and but it would be interesting to hear what other ways that are that frontline workers can support these individuals.
Yeah, definitely. It's just so tricky because I think a lot of the people who work in this sector might have come into it just being completely kind of blindsided by the level of complexity and the level of challenge that they're going to face every day. So, you know, it's really important to make sure that people, workers are supported to be able to support their clients. So I think in terms of the work that we're doing in Manchester and in Salford, it's around trauma-informed care. So like you say, person-centered working, really getting to know the individual and what are their hopes and wishes, what's important to them for their life, finding what motivates them and how would they best like to be supported. So what are the areas from their point of view that they would like help with, and how best can we achieve that? So I think it's lots of basic things such as taking it at the person's pace. As Adam said, working in outreach, because not everybody can come to appointments that are far away or that demand you to jump through various hoops to get to them. We work about being consistent, do what you say you're going to do, don't make false promises. So just being very honest. Also looking at things like the environment. So we do psychologically informed environment training as well for the Greater Manchester area. And that's looking at environments that our homeless clients are going into and how can we make sure that they are trauma informed, that we're thinking about things that might potentially be triggering or distressing. So we're thinking about that and also avoiding asking people to repeat their trauma over and over, because that's one of the things that homeless clients bring to us quite often, is that they've been through lots and lots of services in their lifetime and had to repeat the same things over and over. So I think it's just being aware of how we can avoid that and sharing information in a way that is beneficial for clients. And I think just being non-judgmental. So the workers that I work with, the housing workers, mental health nurses, social workers, everybody's just accepting of people as they are. And I guess just a strong knowledge that people are not, quote, choosing this as a lifestyle. People have been exposed to multiple disadvantages throughout their lives, and this is what survival looks like. It's, you know, so I think that's really important to remember when you're working with homeless people.
Yeah, I think just kind of going back to, you said, at kind of making sure that people aren't having to repeat their story. Yeah, kind of what in previous roles I've worked frontline, it's been a real thing that I've tried to do, and I think it's something that all services should really prioritise, is that we work in partnership with other people and share information with consent to get information about that individual so that we don't have to start from the beginning again and kind of re-traumatise that individual by getting them to tell their story again and again. And I think that's, yeah, it's just the way that people need to work, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, the people that we're working with, as we've talked about childhood adversity, have probably been going through services since they were born or since they were very little, and they've had to repeat this stuff over and over and over, and it's really not acceptable.
Yeah. I also wanted to touch on kind of the element of trust as well. And I think both Adam and you, Michelle, have mentioned the word trust in this episode, and just kind of really approaching the relationship with an individual by firstly building up that trust so that they can talk to you about kind of what they're going through, rather than expecting that they tell you everything about their lives immediately. It's about building that relationship first, having that kind of, that's trust in that relationship, and then moving forward with kind of asking them, what would you like in terms of support as well, rather than saying, this is what I think you need to do. It's kind of giving that ownership on that individual to make that decision.
Yeah, definitely. And just acknowledging that lots of people have probably had relationships that have not worked out, that where people have let them down or broken their trust, or, you know, so there's lots of barriers for that person to get over in order to be able to trust you. And I think we owe it to everybody to make sure that when we get that trust, we honour it.
Absolutely. I'm wondering sort of what the kind of the main challenges are for frontline workers in terms of supporting someone who has co-occurring conditions. I know that's quite a big question, but I'm wondering what some of the challenges you think people will face.
I think because part of my role is supporting the dual diagnosis practitioners, who are nurses and social workers, but also the housing supported tenancies housing workers. And I think some of the things, the challenges that they face on a day-to-day basis are kind of multiple and never ending, I suppose. So the work that they do is extremely complex and emotionally challenging. They're often hearing and experiencing vicarious trauma from the things that they're seeing and hearing at work. So they might be having kind of challenges thrown at them directly, but also they might be experiencing lots and lots of, you know, people talking about suicide, people talking about harming themselves or others, you know, drug and alcohol use and how that impacts on individuals. So there's there's lots of challenges. And I think that when people are recruited to be a housing worker, I think it's highly unlikely that they are aware at the time of the kind of things that they might be facing when they actually do this job.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm wondering how can we support kind of frontline workers who don't have this specialism in co-occurring conditions? Like you said, people can experience vicarious trauma. What can we do to really protect these members of staff and support them in their work?
Yeah, good question, Jo. In Salford, the model, it feels very systemic. So it's working very much with systems around the clients. So much of my role is more working with staff teams rather than homeless people directly. So the types of things that I offer are group reflective practice for housing workers to come together once a month to offer peer support, to think together about some of the challenges, some of the barriers, to kind of jointly problem solve how to work with some of the challenges. I also offer one-to-one sessions, which is just a flexible, open offer for housing workers or dual diagnosis practitioners to come to spend some time thinking about clients, thinking about some of the difficulties that they're facing, talking about some of the real emotional challenges that they're facing and experiencing, and just to be able to sort of get a psychological perspective on that. So I think in Salford, we're really lucky that this psychology input is funded and how we've been able to use it within the partnership. I think another factor is I offer psychological formulation sessions. So with consent, teams can bring clients for us to try and build a better understanding of what might be going on for that person. So it's to try and understand the context behind people's visible behaviour. So the stuff that the housing workers are seeing, it might be very in your face, very much kind of challenging, and we're kind of taking a step back and thinking, okay, what's actually going on for this person? Why might they be behaving in that way? What's behind it? And just having a shared perspective, really. So they're bringing bits about the client, bits about housing, thinking about all the complexities, and then I'm meeting them with a psychological perspective, and we're really trying to build a joint understanding so that then they can go out and support the clients.
Yeah, I think that's really useful, Michelle. I think, like you said, often behaviour might be seen as just very challenging and chaotic. And I guess frontline staff really, like you said, just need to take that step back and say, okay, why is it that this person is displaying this kind of quite challenging behaviour? It's not because he's, you know, just like purposely doing this. It's because of this, 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 and this. And I think that's a really important kind of reflective way of working, is to constantly kind of step back. And it's about encouraging staff to make that as part of their practice, is to be in that reflective mode. I know that can be quite challenging in frontline work, and it's very much kind of reactive and very firefighting. So to be quite reflective can be a little bit challenging, I can imagine.
Yeah, but I think we're really lucky, certainly in Salford, because the team leader for our dual diagnosis homeless team, plus the managers within Salford Council Housing Service, are so supportive of the psychological input. They really value it. They really encourage their staff to utilise it. So it's really well received. And I think if it's built into the sort of ethos and values that are held within the team, then it's really beneficial, and you kind of having input with a lot more people than you would if it was not recognized and not supported by management.
Yeah, absolutely. I've kind of wanted to finish with looking at how can we improve access to mainstream services for people who have kind of co-occurring needs. Again, a big question. I don't know if Adam, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, certainly. And I think the first point is it depends where you're delivering services, because no two areas have the same commissioned service delivery across the board, especially when you're thinking about co-occurring needs. within a population. So it does depend what's available within the area you're delivering. For us, what we've done to try and think about improved access to services, system change and things like that. So within Greater Manchester, there's two mental health NHS delivery trusts. There's ourselves, GMMH and Pennine Care. So we've looked at how we can collaboratively work together with the services we're delivering, but across both delivery areas, to reduce silo working, going back to what Michelle was saying about breaking down barriers when it comes to multiple assessments by different services. So we've our staff that work in those areas have got access to read-only records so that they can review somebody's history once they're consented into working with us. And through doing so, we can look at anything information that that person might have shared in the past to inform our understanding and reduce the need to put somebody back through conversations that may risk re-traumatising them that could lead to disengagement. So I think collaborative working is key across any services, whether it be the NHS or any other service providers. So our integration with the Rough Sleeping and the local authority teams to think about how we support them to understand in the ways that Michelle's discussed already, but then also other healthcare providers. There's a lot of different substance providers within Greater Manchester. It's not as simple as the two NHS trust model. You've got primary care and secondary care mental health. So there's a lot to be done around how you integrate and how you collaboratively work. As a way of trying to build a process into that system-wide approach, we've brought together our different homeless services under what we call a hub model. So the different members of MDTs within those multidisciplinary teams within those services can work across the service models when there's a need to consider somebody's specific needs. So we've got social workers and nurses, as Michelle's talked about. We've got clinical and other frontline psychologists. We've got consultant psychiatrists, but then we've also got some more specialist roles such as neuropsychology and speech and language therapy. So we can think about some of the impacts that people's lifestyles that they've been living might impact on how they understand information, how we share information with them, how we support that wider MDT workforce to understand those things and deliver information, facilitate assessments. It's looking at integration of our services as well, not just how we integrate with the services we might refer on to or that we're working in partnership with. And then we have a what we call a homeless operational group, which brings together our hub model and then what we refer to as our spoke contacts. So within the mainstream delivery services within the trust and also with links from Pennine Care as well, we have homeless leads within those services. So they would attend the meeting with ourselves so we can talk about barriers and challenges within the delivery models and think about conversations around system change, so where those traditional models are maybe being posing problems for individuals or for our delivery and referral in. We can have collaborative conversations about that. We can share information looking at best practice. So we've benchmarked our services on the new NICE guidance to be assured that we are delivering services in line with best practice. And then we're going to look at doing some work with the mainstream services to understand where there might be a need for system change to align to some of those recommended practices. As Michelle mentioned, we also offer psychologically informed environments training. So that's about sharing what we understand about how to work with people who are homeless so that we can build capacity in our wider workforce. But then we're also doing a piece of work. We've had a training coordinator funded to do a training needs analysis across the sector. So looking at what do we need to bring to our staff in relation to their understanding of that wider part of the sector in relation to benefits, housing and everything else. So there's a shared understanding about how why barriers might come up and who we go to and what we do in order to try and work around overcoming those. When you're looking at system change, it's important to be able to say it's okay to get it wrong and to deliver a model where you're allowed to test and change. So within the models that we've got and the commissioning infrastructure that overpins those, we're allowed to do something and then have a reflective conversation about whether or not that's worked and think about what we might do differently. So we're not stuck with that original model that we thought might work. And a lot of that links into considering lived experience as well, co-production. So training that's delivered with people who've lived through trauma, who might know positive approaches to harm reduction, to not assuming that as a professional with a background knowledge in something, that means that we know everything there is to know about how to do something, listening to people's own experiences and bringing those experiences to influence and inform how we choose to deliver services, and recognizing that maybe sometimes it's not the best way of doing it just because that's what traditional models suggest is the right way.
Yeah, I think, sorry, I was just saying that the kind of the involvement of people of lived experience is like absolutely key to making sure that you're kind of delivering those services and addressing in a way that is addressing the needs of the people that use them. Sorry, do continue.
No. I was just going to say as well, I think one of the other things we try to do as much as possible, whether it be within our assessment phase or when it's part of looking at transitions and things, is looking at co-working. So as Michelle sort of alluded to as well, thinking about the experience for somebody to go through an assessment, can we either complete that assessment where, so in Manchester, for example, the substance use provider is a different provider to our mental health trust. So we've got staff that are funded through Rough Sleeper Drug and Alcohol Treatment Grants to work with CGL, who's the delivery provider in Manchester, and consider where it's appropriate, where can we do sort of co-facilitated assessments so that we can ask the questions that we need to once as two different services, and then look at how collaboratively we then formulate what do we do next, and then take away our individual actions, but only putting somebody through that process once if it's possible to be able to do that. So there's a lot about that in relation to how you do things, but you've got to have the flexibility in the delivery model and the expectations from commissioners to allow you to be able to do that and take your time, because anything that's rushed isn't going to work, likely isn't going to work. And then managing transitions and endings is also key, because by the time you've taken such a long period of time to build up a relationship with somebody and build their trust, there's a potential level of positive dependence on the service or the individual member of staff they're working with. So that transition from that person to another service or back to more independence is going to be difficult. So you've got to recognize that, and you've got to have a model that allows for transitions, supported transitions as well.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. There's so much amazing information there that I think a lot of services will find incredibly useful. Unfortunately, I think that's all we have time for, but thank you both so much for coming and speaking with me today. It's been really useful to understand the link between homelessness and co-occurring conditions and think about what good practice looks like in terms of support. But yes, thank you so much, Adam and Michelle, for your time.
Thanks for listening. To keep up to date with the latest goings on at HomelessLink, please follow us on Twitter at HomelessLink. If you're interested in training and development opportunities for yourself, your team, or your organisation, get in touch by emailing training@homelesslink.org.uk. We have a range of courses that help staff and organisations develop the skills needed to tackle current issues and improve services.